So Devashish was answering that question about gradual and quantum leap. Is that over, the question, the answer, I mean?
Yes. Yes,
Okay.
yeah, he said that when it's digital, it's a real experience and that's not really available.
Okay, I will read the next one. There are different orders of reality. The objective and physical is only one order. It is convincing to the physical or externalizing mind because it is directly obvious to the senses. While of the subjective and the supraphysical, that mind has no means of knowledge except from fragmentary signs and data and inferences which are at every step liable to error. Our subjective movements and inner experiences are a domain of happenings as real as any outward physical happenings. But if the individual mind can know something of its own phenomena by direct experience, it is ignorant of what happens in the consciousness of others, except by analogy with its own or such signs, data, inferences as its outward observation can give it. I am therefore inwardly real to myself, but the invisible life of others has only an indirect reality to me, except in so far as it impinges on my own mind, life, and senses. This is the limitation of the physical mind of man, and it creates in him a habit of believing entirely only in the physical and of doubting or challenging all that does not come into accord with his own experiences or his own scope of understanding or square with his own standard or sum of established knowledge.
So here Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that there is a certain kind of natural tendency to prioritize the evidence of the external senses over subjective reality. And this is also particularly true, as he'll point out in the very next paragraph, in our modern times, when we've almost taken a kind of a collective decision
De facto.
to come to a consensual understanding of the physical world. What is this physical world? What is as the object of our collective understanding and collective senses? We can come to a consensus about it because we all see, experience sent through our senses the same world. And so there is a certain kind of a accumulation, one may say, of evidence that occurs. And this is one of the very basic premises of the process of science, that through the accumulation of repeatable or verifiable experiments based on extensions of external senses, we can arrive at conclusions that we can collectively share. And if we want to extend this to our subjective world, it becomes very difficult to do. Because where is this verification? Where is the possibility of such a verification? That's why he's pointing out over there, our subjective movements and inner experiences are a domain of happenings as real. But if the individual mind can know something of its own phenomena by direct experience, it is ignorant of what happens in the consciousness of others, except by analogy with its own or such signs, data, inferences as its outward observation can give. So here, this is the problem. This is one of the major problems why the superphysical science, if you want to call it that, the science of subjectivity is such a questionable thing. One calls it parapsychology or some kind of a questionable pseudoscience, if one tries to arrive at this kind of a consensual reality based on inner experience. But he is saying that such an inner science is a necessity. And we can see that, in a sense, psychology is an attempt to get in that direction, particularly when we see things like Jungian psychology, which translates our dreams, for example, into certain symbolic structures and sees commonalities there, can classify them, can arrive at certain meanings based on them. Now, these meanings may be suspect and may depend on even deeper universalities of subjective experience that can be accumulated through a variety of concurrences, through different people's experiences. But through all these means of actually arriving at deeper understandings that collate, that accumulate the inner experiences, we are also going deeper into a kind of understanding that is derived not so much from objectivity, but from knowledge by identity. We are moving towards the root of identity, and we are moving towards it by an openness more and more to an intuition which can clarify the kinds of experiences we are having. And in dwelling in such intuitive domains, we can concur with others who also have such similar intuitive experiences. So it is through an introspective process and a process of entering into subjective experience and a deepening of this that we can perhaps come to a kind of accumulation of subjective science. And this is partly the Vedantic method that he clarifies elsewhere and earlier in this very text, where he talks about the methods of Vedantic knowledge.
So is subjective knowledge by definition outside the scope of verification?
No, that's the point he's making. It's outside the scope of verification by the external senses. And so it depends on other forms for its verification. It depends on our dependence on other kinds of identities or other kinds of consensuses. Now, if we don't admit that, if we make an a priori decision that that does not exist, we do not have any source of unity. Ultimately, it's a question of finding a source of unity. The easiest source of unity is to say that we are all constituted with sense organs, that we are all one in. I mean, we all have the same constitution of sense organs and the same way of operating of the sensory mind. So, and then also the rational mind, the inferential mind. But that kind of basis of unity restricts us to the knowledge of the objective world only perceivable by the senses or through the extension of the senses through instruments. But there are verification methods, and that's the point he's making. So long as we don't admit that, then the knowledge of the inner world remains absent in any kind of universal way to us. It only remains real to us personally.
So is he going to talk further about the methods of verifications, or did he already mention them here and I missed it?
No, he doesn't mention them here at all, actually. I'm just going ahead a little bit.
Sure, no problem.
In this particular paragraph and also in this chapter, he doesn't really go into it. But this is what backgrounds what he's talking about, in a sense, in this paragraph.
Another question about the outer senses and their verification. How do we know that something that I experience as a certain object with my outer senses is the same as somebody else's experiences using those same outer senses? I mean, using his outer senses.
That's the consensual nature of accumulated knowledge. How do we understand? We cannot understand, again, in an a priori way, but we describe it to each other. And that's how science also proceeds, basically through repeatability. if we can, our descriptions of our experiments based on our senses are repeatable and understandable by each other, then we are arriving at some kind of a consensual reality. But there also, as your question implies, there are gray areas. And the whole movement of Impressionism, for example, as an art movement in France in the middle of the 19th century, began with this very question that you're asking, that even if we say that we can describe it to each other, still we don't know whether we are having the same experience or not.
Yes, and that's the question, yeah.
Yes, and that's true, that's valid. That's a valid point, and that becomes the beginning of a deeper subjectivity and a dependence on deeper methods of subjective of knowing.
Yeah. Well, I have here, can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah.
Yes, Dr. Dick.
My very fundamental question is, say, when I say that I have tasted sugar, I know what sweetness is. Now, you taste it. My question is, what sensation or experience that I gather, how do I know that the other person has exactly gathered the same thing? It may be different. Well, maybe, may not be. But the question is, are we sure that when we see or experience one particular object with our own senses, individual person, different person has the same experience? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Am I clear? Yes, Dr. Dev, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. That is it. People can do experiments on the reactions and the hormones, and we can know all the kind of secretions that take place when one tastes sugar, for example, and there can be commonalities in that.
Yes.
But these are all symptoms. And we can say that we all have the same symptoms, therefore we must be having the same experience. So this is it's a second-hand description of experience. All we can really tell is that the symptoms are the same.
Yeah, if symptoms are all, everything same, and as you mentioned very particularly, the secretion of hormone is the basic thing. What the hormones that have been secreted in me are all the hormones that is secreted in the other person. If that is true, then it is certainly true. I think that's the only thing we can at least assert at the moment, that the experiences are the same.
Yeah, we can go that far, but still we don't know what the quality of taste is.
Right.
We can only infer it in terms of its symptoms, that the same kinds of objective phenomena are being produced.
Yeah.
But what was the taste like? That remains a truth or a reality of the subjective world. And that, again, is something which we can only concur about if we admit that there are equivalences in subjective experience, that in some way or form, sweet, the term sweet, has meaning. And that meaning ultimately goes towards some kind of a deeper symbolic reality in which something beyond the subject and object is expressing itself in these kinds of experiences.
Yeah. Well, you know, it may not be relevant here, but may be relevant here, that once we were talking about God, now a little experiment gave me a very good idea that it's a paper I'd write in 1 minute. What is the definition of God? And everybody gave a different thing. No, nobody's answer was the same. But we say, we know God. He said, this is, how do you solve this problem when you talk about God? Well, this is not a religious subject. It's a subject by itself. It can take days, months, or years, I don't know. But this idea is connected, that the experiences, what I feel and what you feel, and with the same circumstances, are the identical. That is the main question. And that's what
Yes, Dr. Deh, you are right there too, and it is connected. It is connected because subjective reality is not like objective reality. And that's why he's making the point that it you cannot use the same kind of methods of verification to verify it. Subjective reality, it's just like dreams. I was talking about a movement towards subjective reality, for example, in Jungian psychology, because we don't have the same dreams. We all have different dreams. But if we are to make sense of these dreams in some universal way, arrive at universal meanings, your dreams and my dreams may be about two totally different things, but they may actually be pointing to the same meaning.
Could be, yeah.
And just like you said, the definition of God may be totally different to everybody, but they're pointing to the same thing.
So pointing to the same idea.
So just as even in our objective understanding, we try to build systems in which there is a taxonomy, a classification. There are genus and species. So too in subjective experience, there may be taxonomies in which symbols ultimately cohere and point to greater and deeper ideas, and these ideas may be manifest in different ways or through different ideas and sub ideas and symbols, but ultimately there is a certain kind of a gathering of these into realities that are universal.
I have a question. Another question. I just wanted to know. I have a sequence of experience that, in this regard, that say, if I have take sugar, it tastes sweet, and I feel there is a certain, body reaction, which has some commonalities amongst, other human beings. That's my assumption says, depending on the biology and medical science and everything. And if I try to go deeper, it's like it really matters whether I liked it or not. I mean, it doesn't matter, what the body language is tell me. It comes to, okay, good or bad. And that depends on the situation. Sometimes it is good, sometimes it is bad, and it's very conditioned. And if I go even deeper than that sometimes, that does it really matter whether it was good or bad? Sometimes it actually disappears. So would you be able to illustrate a little bit on that?
Sugar disappears.
Yes, if you're talking about our sensory experiences and their results in our experience, in a subjective experience, the taste, as it were, of things, and taste may, as you point out, may not necessarily have to do with just senses and their physical experiences, but also senses and their mental experiences. For example, we may look at a landscape, and that also ultimately translates itself into good or bad. It's either, it's raga, dvesha, as they call it. Is there a shrinking or is there an attraction to it? And this configuration of experience in terms of attractions and repulsions is part of our, conditioned reality. And what exactly the experience is becomes more abstract or abstractly configured in terms of these kind of pleasurable and unpleasurable feelings. And then, as you're saying, some of them persist and some of them don't persist. And that also has to do with their depth, or their they may be due to two reasons. One is that there is a habitual charge that is greater or deeper in certain cases, and the other may be that there is something of a symbolic reality which transcends the superficialities of experience that ultimately has a universal quality to it. So for either of these two reasons, there may be a certain kind of a persistence. And habitual realities also are only conditioned persistences. You cannot, a change of consciousness will get rid of it. But universal realities do not have conditioned, tastes. There is a persistence of something more stable that transcends the pull of attractions and repulsions in these universal stabilities of experience that stands behind them, as it were. Is that something that moves towards explaining what you were saying?
Yes, basically, that is a, I think what you're referring to is just like life form, like a, like since even if I die, another human being will be born, so the human being, the form will remain. Is that what you're saying? That persistence?
Yeah, in a sense, but also persistence of experience, or of the taste of experience.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That about the taste, are you are you referring to the similar kind that the form, that, you know, life forms that continues to persist?
Yeah, that is one kind of persistence, but also in the individual, in one lifetime itself, the tastes change and certain tastes disappear, as it were.
Or exactly.
Yeah, and also one may have a taste in the immediate experience of a sensory perception, but in the memory that may disappear, that may not have any kind of retention or persistence. But some of them have persistence, and those which have persistence may either have to do with what in Sanskrit is called samskaras, that there are certain habitual formations that ultimately are trapped in those kind of senses or sensations, or it may have to do with universal realities. For example, an experience of God or a touch of divine experience will always bring a certain kind of taste. And even in memory, it will bring that taste. It will not disappear, as it were. So there is a universal reality over there which transcends or which is manifest in whatever external sensory way in which it was received.
I muted the microphone and then talked. So you are talking about if I'm receptive to that universality of the taste of sugar, then it won't disappear, but it will get a different grade of meaning.
Yeah, that is also part of what one might call the depth of symbolic or subjective experience. That is, for example, when Sri Ramakrishna says, "I want to eat sugar, not become sugar," he's using the word sugar in a symbolic form over here. Ultimately, the sweetness of sugar is not just the pleasure of the senses, but points to the sweetness of God. And his experience is actually touching that experience. It's transcending the sensory experience and actually becoming an occasion for the experience of the sweetness of God. And so if the touch of that is there, either by divine grace or by the depth of one's own subjectivity, then that becomes persistent, that retains its quality. Sugar itself becomes then like a divine icon. Just like a little stone piece, the divine can come into it that way.
So it is like, are you talking about like Sri Aurobindo? I think you only mentioned that Sri Aurobindo was feeling the pleasure in the pain.
Yes.
Is that the kind of thing that you are referring to, right?
Yes, ultimately, absolutely. That is ultimately, you're absolutely right. That is ultimately what I'm referring to, because ultimately, everything, even beyond this pleasure and pain duality, is a form of divine bliss or ananda. And if it can be, if there is a transformation of the senses, then there is a touch of that that enters into our experience, whatever comes to us.
I have a question about the very first line, and it may be a little unrelated.
Yes.
So he says orders of reality. So would you say that these orders of reality, as you go higher in consciousness, are extensions of the reality that you experienced, or are they completely different experiences of reality?
What you will experience is that they are not extensions of the physical order of reality, but that the physical order of reality is an extension of them. That is, you move in higher orders of reality closer and closer to a knowledge by identity. And the knowledge by identity is something which ultimately gives you an intuition. In its lower grades of reality, knowledge by identity becomes knowledge by inner contact, knowledge through intuition. And ultimately, it becomes externalized knowledge. These are the three major forms of knowledge that Sri Aurobindo will talk about. So what we realize then is that our external experiences are of an order of reality that is a shadow or a representation of the deeper orders of reality.
So those orders really don't invalidate this, but rather put them in a certain perspective.
Yes. They may invalidate them in the sense that they may give different values to them. Just like even in our ordinary scientific understanding of the world, our perception that the earth moves around the sun is not a given sensory perception. A sensory perception is that the sun moves around the earth. But a higher order of understanding gives us a different value to that particular experience. So similarly, our values may change and our experience itself will change accordingly as we enter higher orders of reality.
Thank you.
Okay, there is something. Can you hear me talking?
Yes.
This is an interesting thing here in my screen, that my name doesn't appear, but you can hear me. That's interesting. In my screen, I don't have my name.
Yeah, you see only other people's names in there.
Yeah, I see other people.
Yeah, that's how it's expected to be.
And I do not know one person, G. Mehta, 14. I haven't met him before. Is Mr. Mehta is here?
Yeah, hello, how are you? Who are you?
Hi.
Hi.
You are Mehta?
Yes, I am. I'm Jyoti. How are you?
Oh, dear Mehta, okay.
Yes.
How are you? Hi, yeah.
Shall we continue the Vashishtha reading?
Yes, please.
Shyam, you want throat pain? Okay. Well, today, Sita, you can read, you'll get recorded.
Different orders of reality, right?
The next one, this egocentric.
That you just said.
That was it then. This egocentric.
This egocentric attitude has in recent times been elevated into a valid standard of knowledge. It has been implicitly are explicitly held as an axiom that all truth must be referred to the judgment of the personal mind, reason, and experience of every man, or else it must be verified, or at any rate verifiable by a common or universal experience in order to be valid. But obviously, this is a false standard of reality and of knowledge, since this means the sovereignty of the normal or average mind and its limited capacity and experience, the exclusion of what is supernormal or beyond the average intelligence. In its extreme, this claim of the individual to be the judge of everything is an egoistic illusion, a superstition of the physical mind. In the mass, a gross and vulgar error. The truth behind it is that each man has to think for himself, know for himself, according to his capacity, but his judgment can be valid only on condition that he is ready to learn and open always to a larger knowledge. It is reason that to depart from the physical standard and the principle of personal or universal verification will lead to gross delusions and the admission of unverified truth and subjective fantasy into the realm of knowledge. But error and delusion and the introduction of personality and one's own subjectivity into the pursuit of knowledge are always present, and the physical or objective standards and methods do not exclude them. The probability of error is no reason for refusing to attempt discovery, and subjective discovery must be pursued by a subjective method of inquiry, observation, and verification. Research into the supraphysical must evolve, accept, and test an appropriate means and methods other than those by which one examines the constituents of physical objects and the process of energy in material nature.
So here Sri Aurobindo is continuing the idea that he introduced in the previous paragraph, and also pointing to the predominance of this kind of a convention of truth in our modern times, that this insistence on the primacy of objective external knowledge, or knowledge of the through the external senses, has been elevated into a valid standard of knowledge, as he says over there, and that it is only the lowest common denominator of personal judgment, reason, and experience that can bring us to any kind of understanding of that is a valid understanding of our world. But then, as he has introduced in the previous pages amply, he has pointed out how this is a extremely slippery ground and an extremely, one may say, baseless foundation for coming to true knowledge. That's why he says that, but obviously this is a false standard of reality and of knowledge. Since this means the sovereignty of the normal or average mind and its limited capacity and experience, the exclusion of what is supernormal or beyond the average intelligence. So here, this ultimately as a domain of knowledge brings us into various forms of psychological experiences. And in fact, this way of thinking that Sri Aurobindo is pointing out has been behind a large number of modern Western approaches to psychology. Modern approaches to psychology. I talked about Jungian psychology, but even philosophers like psychologists like Adler have made this the basis that we, instead of building our understandings of the subjective world on average experiences, should build them on the basis of excellence or of ideals. Ideals, not of ideas, but ideals of experience, that we gravitate towards personalities that seem to us to be greater than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That is because they have some component of being and experience that we find to be of a greater relevance, that in some way is a higher mode of experience. And so that should be more our datum for describing superphysical or subjective experience than common or ordinary experiences of human beings. Now, this has also led to the opening up of the whole field now of what is called transpersonal psychology, which is really an attempt towards, I feel, what Sri Aurobindo is calling over here, this research into the superphysical, which has to find its own means and methods other than those by which one examines the constituents of physical objects and the processes of energy in material nature. And what are these means and methods? These themselves are in the making, but the field of transpersonal psychology takes it at least that the person, the human ego, is something that is transitional, that it does stretch out of its own limits into various transpersonal states that ultimately lead to what one might call objective subjectivities, that are universal subjective conditions of experience. So if there are such universal subjective conditions of experience, what are the intervening grades between normal or average subjectivity and that kind of subjectivity?
Mm.
How can we arrive at a classification of experiences? How can we arrive at a classification of aims and a variety of connections between these? Actually, this is the whole field of what Vedantic knowledge is called darshan. Darshana and yoga go together. And darshana and yoga are related in this very way as what modern Western knowledge we are groping towards in calling a transpersonal psychology. But he's saying that this is the need of the hour, as it were, that we must develop this.
So in the record of yoga of Sri Aurobindo, he has done a lot of experiments in these fields. Is that right?
Yes, Record of Yoga is a very interesting document which is largely inaccessible to most of us because of its interiority, that it's really Sri Aurobindo's diary to himself. But he would maintain such a diary exactly like a scientist. It's a scientist of the subjective world and of subjective growth. Really, one can call it a transpersonal subjective diary. And so it is a yogic diary, and in a sense, it is exactly through the maintenance of this kind of meticulous, detailed study of the experiences and movements of the inner consciousness that one can arrive at this kind of a superphysical science. It is through a translation, and you know, it's a very advanced study, but people like Richard Hartz, for example, are trying to undertake such a study of correlating this very internal personal language, as one finds in Record of Yoga, to the language of Synthesis of Yoga or to the language of Savitri. What are the experiences he's talking about over there? What are the consistencies and persistencies that are mentioned over there? So that, yes, that is a kind of approach towards what he's calling superphysical research.
So the Kundalini Yoga is also another such field of discovering the supraphysical.
All yogas are fields of discovering the supraphysical. But yoga as a field of discovering the supraphysical can be just a set of procedures. And that's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about actually laying out that field, of actually arriving at an internal understanding of the field and making it something which is universal. He's talking about laying out darshana and yoga simultaneously, as it were.
Okay, because this is in the realm of knowledge rather than in the realm of getting siddhis or practicing occultism.
Yes.
If you're not reading anymore, I have a slightly unrelated question.
Yes.
So when we read the Life Divine or the Synthesis, we read, for example, all is Brahman, there is divine everywhere, which are not normal to our experience. So as we keep thinking about it during our daily life, there's a tendency to kind of remind ourselves of it and simulate it in the mind. Which is not really an experience itself, but it's kind of disciplining the mind to think about this. But that's really not the real thing. So,
Hello? Yes.
No, Lopa got disconnected.
Uh-huh. Oh. Lopa. Okay. Sorry. Yeah, Shyam can ask the question again.
Yeah. So I wanted to find out, what the value of that simulation is, and if it's something that should be resisted.
I didn't hear your question, Shyam. Can you start from the beginning again?
Yeah. Sure. So the question was, when you read the Life Divine or this,
we dropped.
Hello, are we there?
Yeah, no, you're still there.
Yeah. So when we read these books and when we read what Sri Aurobindo is saying, many things which are not normal to our experience, such as like everything is divine, all is Brahman, we try to simulate it in the mind by reminding ourselves or in a way disciplining ourselves. I wanted to know what is the validity of that method and whether that really takes anything any far, because it's really not an experience but just playing with the mind there.
No, it is meditation. Sri Aurobindo, actually, interestingly, the very thing that you brought up, dwelling on ideas is meditation. Dwelling or putting one's concentration on an idea is a meditation. And so if there is something which one has heard from somebody who has entered into a larger realm of consciousness, and by a variety of ways one has actually been attracted to that, and this is actually laying out the field of the supraphysical science, that it has to have other methods of even proceeding. And one of the methods of proceeding, it cannot actually be just undertaken by anybody. It has to be undertaken due to an inner need felt, and that inner need is often connected to a certain kind of an attraction, if you want to call it that, to somebody's experience. because an affinity is felt, an intuitive affinity is felt. So by intuitive affinity, we already are positing some kind of a root of knowledge by identity, the psychic knowledge, which is a intuitive psychic intuition that makes us begin on this path, already is something that knows about these things. It's stirring a kind of inherent knowledge in us. So when we hear words like, or sentences like, all this is the Brahman, then there is something in us which draws us to actually focus our attention. There are even moments in our lives when just hearing a sentence like that can transfix us without our knowing how or why. The whole being is ultimately just caught up in that meditation. So it's not just a playing with the mind, but an opening to inner reaches that ultimately put us into contact with these ideas that somebody has experienced and that have a universal validity as a result.
Just to expand on that, so in qualitatively, is there any difference between that and what we casually refer to as, say, daydreaming or as daydreaming?
Yes, of course. Daydreaming is something which is a unconnected sequence of thoughts that the conscious raises into the mind. And so daydreaming is really a connection between the conscious and subconscious parts of the mind, and doesn't have that, any focus to it, not even a subliminal focus to it. Now, there are forms of daydreaming that, for example, poetic sequences, that a poet, when a poet writes a poem, sometimes it's like a daydream, because the whole sequence comes in a kind of a coherent form of knitted or connected ideas. This is not really the usual daydreaming. This is a inner reach of consciousness, a subliminal layer of consciousness that is impressing itself on the surface consciousness. Now, further than that, if one actually dwells on ideas like all this is the Brahman, then it becomes even more than that. There is actually the focusing of the inner mind on an idea and an attempt to see the reality of that idea in everything around you. It's a much more focused activity. The will of the Purusha is behind it.
Sure. Thank you, Devashista.
Okay, so should we read a last paragraph? Sita, can you, do you think it's time to do that?
Yeah, we can read it without discussing and we can conclude because it's 9:30.
Yes.
So let's just read it once. Sham, do you want to read it?
Sure. To refuse to inquire upon any general ground, preconceived and a priori, is an obscurantism as prejudicial to the extension of knowledge as the religious obscurantism which opposed in Europe the extension of scientific discovery. The greatest inner discoveries, the experience of self-being, the cosmic consciousness, the inner calm of the liberated spirit, the direct effect of mind upon mind, the knowledge of things by consciousness in direct contact with other consciousness or with its objects. Most spiritual experiences of any value cannot be brought before the tribunal of the common mentality, which has no experience of these things and takes its own absence or incapacity of experience as a proof of their invalidity or their non-existence. Physical truth of formulas, generalizations, discoveries founded upon physical observations can be so referred. But even there, a training of capacity is needed before one can truly understand and judge. It is not every untrained mind that can follow the mathematics of relativity or other difficult scientific truths or judge of the validity either of their result or their process. All reality, all experience must indeed, to be held as true, be capable of verification by a same or similar experience. So, in fact, All men can have a spiritual experience and can follow it out and verify it in themselves. But only when they have acquired the capacity or can follow the inner methods by which that experience and verification are made possible. It is necessary to dwell for a moment on these obvious and elementary truths, because the opposite ideas have been sovereign in a recent period of human mentality. They are now only receding, and have stood in the way of the development of a vast domain of possible knowledge. It is of supreme importance for the human spirit to be free to sound the depths of inner or subliminal reality, of spiritual and of what is still superconscient reality, and not to immure itself in the physical mind and its narrow domain of objective external solidities. For in that way alone can there come liberation from the ignorance in which our mentality dwells, and a release into a complete consciousness, a true and integral self-realization and self-knowledge.